Well, last Sunday evening we began a brief series looking at the matter of church membership. And there in our first session, last Sunday, we considered the background to church membership. And tonight, in our second session, I'd like us to consider the justification for church membership. And I suppose that this is a particularly pertinent issue in light of the fact that there's no verse anywhere in the Bible that says explicitly you must become officially a member of your local church. You can search the Bible high and low and you simply won't find that kind of a verse. And so in the light then of that biblical silence, it's a very natural question, isn't it? Is there really any justification for this practice of church membership? Well, obviously, I want to answer that yes, there is. And I'd like us to look at this in the form of three distinct points this evening. First of all, church membership recognizes a biblical fact. Church membership recognizes a biblical fact. And this fact that I'm referring to is the one that emerged from our study last week. Namely, that if you are a Christian, if you are a saved person, if you are someone who has experienced God's salvation, then you are in fact already a member of the church. Because as we saw last week, the only salvation that God has ever undertaken is the salvation of the church. And the only salvation that there is to be enjoyed, therefore, is to be enjoyed within the church. And the only Christian conversion that there is to be experienced, therefore, is that of incorporation into the church. There's simply no such thing as a Christian who isn't a member of the church. The Bible doesn't say that there on the cross of Calvary, the Lord Jesus Christ laid down his life for the church, plus a few other random oddbods who are in a different category. They're just Christians. They're just followers of Jesus. No, if you are a Christian, if you are a follower of Jesus, then unavoidably and inescapably and inevitably, you are a member of the church. And so when, therefore, at Newcastle Reformed Evangelical Church or at Welbeck Road Evangelical Church or at Wooler or at any other local church up and down the land or indeed across the world, whenever a person is formally welcomed and admitted into church membership, it's simply a very obvious and a very visible and a very unmistakable recognition of this basic Christian truth. Now, there are, of course, many people who are, in fact, members of that church for which the Lord Jesus Christ died on the cross, who aren't members of a local church in the formal official sense. Some of those people, they perhaps don't have anything to do whatsoever, in fact, with a local church. They never so much as darken the doors of a local church. Others may be quite involved in the local church, but they haven't formally entered into membership. And it may be that you're in that category tonight. Well, it seems to me that those people are reinforcing this unbiblical idea that God is saving merely a whole bunch of individuals. And they're obscuring this biblical truth that God is, in fact, saving a church, to function as a church, to function, as we saw last week, as a temple in which he himself dwells and as an organic body made up of interdependent parts. That's what God is doing. That's what he's about. He's not merely going down this great tick list, right? I'm saving Joe Bloggs, and I'm saving John Smith, and I'm saving this person, and I'm saving that person. No, God is, in converting people, he's constructing a temple. He's creating a body. That's what he's doing. And it seems to me that by refraining from becoming formal members of a local church, by refraining from doing that, unwittingly no doubt, we are obscuring that fact. And we are reinforcing this unbiblical idea that God is simply saving a whole load of random, isolated individuals. So it seems to me that is in fact the greatest justification of all for church membership. That it's recognizing this biblical fact that we are, if we are Christians, whether we like it or not, we are members of the church. So that's the first thing. Church membership recognizes a biblical fact. But secondly, church membership facilitates biblical leadership. Church membership facilitates biblical leadership. Now, as I've already said, there may be no direct references in the Bible to church membership, but there are, of course, many direct references in the Bible to church leadership. And it seems to me, in fact, that even before you go any further, that fact alone strongly suggests the necessity of church membership. Because in any sphere, whether it's the sphere of politics or the sphere of business or whatever, you can't really have leadership without having a specific and clearly demarcated constituency within which that leadership is to be recognized. So, for instance, if you're a pupil at school and you one day get called into the headmaster's office, and so you go along and you walk in and the headmaster is sitting there beaming at you, and he says, "I've got a very important announcement to make to you, that I'm appointing you captain. I'm appointing you as captain." And then he promptly shakes your hand, says congratulations, and ushers you out of his office. Well, at one level that would seem very impressive, wouldn't it? But in another way, of course, it's absolutely meaningless. Captain of what? Captain of who? You wouldn't have a clue who you are supposed to be captain of. Does it mean that you can, after that, walk down the corridors of the school barking orders at all your fellow pupils? Does it mean you can walk down the corridors barking orders at the teachers, at the head himself? Who are you the captain of? It doesn't really make sense. You can't actually go out and act as a captain. But if, on the other hand, the headmaster calls you into his office and he smiles at you and he says, "I've got an announcement to make. I'm making you captain of the football team," then that makes sense, doesn't it? Then you know who you're the captain of. You know that it gives you the right to bark orders, not at every single pupil in the school, but at those other 10 players out there on the football pitch with you. And so you can go out and you can act as a captain. Now, consider with me two aspects of leadership in the New Testament. First of all, consider the language of leadership in the New Testament. Language like those several passages in which the church leader, the elder, is described as an overseer. Or that passage 1 Timothy 5:17, where again the elder is referred to by Paul writing to Timothy as one who rules within the church. Now, of course, we would resist, wouldn't we, any tyrannical and despotic and inappropriately intrusive model of church leadership. But you can't deny that those kind of passages, that kind of language, is certainly pointing to a profound involvement of the leader, of the elder, in the lives of his people. He's overseeing his people. I was listening to a sermon recently by Sinclair Ferguson, and in this sermon he talked a bit about the reason why in kind of traditional church buildings you have this huge pulpit that's raised so high. And he says that the rationale behind that wasn't so much that everyone in the congregation could see the preacher. It was the other way around. It was so that the preacher could see everyone in the congregation, so that he could see who was there, who wasn't there, so that he could see whether people were listening to his preaching, whether they weren't. He could monitor every twitch, every shuffle, every yawn, every flicker of interest. He could see everything that was going on. Now, I don't know whether or not that's a correct explanation of the history of church pulpits, but it seems to me a very vivid illustration of the role of an elder in the New Testament, overseeing his people, watching, being alert to, being sensitive to what is going on in the lives of his flock, of his people. And so he oversees them. And then that other term that I pointed you to, he rules within the church. In other words, he doesn't just oversee his people, but he is responsible for steering and directing the course of his people's lives. Now, it seems to me that this profoundly involved leadership that the New Testament points to, this leadership of profound involvement on the part of the leader in the lives of his people, that in itself requires a well-defined and clearly demarcated church. It's a bit like the way in which a mother would have no qualms at all about rummaging through her own child's hair for lice. But it would be fundamentally inappropriate for her to just stop some random child on the street and start rummaging through his hair for lice. And in the same way, there'd be something fundamentally inappropriate about an elder exercising this kind of oversight we're talking about, this kind of rule that we're talking about, in the life of someone who wasn't in fact part of his flock, part of his people. And remember that we know from 1 Corinthians 14, verses 23 to 25, that in New Testament congregations, there were unbelievers who would walk in. There were unbelievers who would come in and be present in the New Testament churches. And so it seems to me then that there must always have been something along the lines of church membership to provide this necessary demarcation, so that this involved, almost intrusive but not quite intrusive, leadership of New Testament elders was being exercised appropriately in the lives of the people it should have been exercised in. So there's the language of leadership in the New Testament, but then there's the manner of leadership in the New Testament. We read earlier from Acts 6, and those first few verses, and it's a fascinating passage, isn't it? You all know it, the way in which there's this problem within the Jerusalem church. There's this complaint made by the Greeks about the Jews, the fact that the Greeks' widows have been overlooked in the daily distribution of food. And so this is a problem that the leaders, the 12, have to deal with. And so they come to the decision that what needs to happen is there needs to be 7 people appointed, and the responsibility for the distribution of food needs to be handed over, needs to be entrusted to them. And so, what do they do then? How do they go about this? Do they just say, right, let's choose 7 people then, and they choose 7 people? No, they entrust this responsibility, don't they, to the church. They entrust this responsibility to the congregation, to the people under them. Verse 3, brothers, choose 7 men from among you who are known to be full of the Spirit and wisdom. We will turn this responsibility over to them. So that then is how they lead in the midst of this crisis that has arisen. They lead entrusting significant responsibility to the church. And again, that too surely requires a well-defined and clearly demarcated church. Because again, we come back to this, that there were within the New Testament churches, there were unbelievers. Now, you wouldn't want unbelievers being given the responsibility of choosing seven men full of the Spirit and of wisdom and so on to be responsible for the distribution of food. There needed to be clear demarcation. There needed from the start to be something along the lines of church membership. Because not only of the language of leadership in the New Testament, but also because of the manner of leadership, the way in which it wasn't leadership in which nothing was entrusted to the people, but it did entrust decisions and matters to the people. So it seems to me then that church membership, it not only recognizes the biblical fact, it facilitates biblical leadership by demarcating and defining those over whom that leadership is to be exercised. But then thirdly, church membership makes possible a biblical control. Church membership makes possible a biblical control. Now, we said last time, and I mentioned it in my prayer earlier on, that the church, there are various metaphors that the New Testament uses, but two of the primary ones are the metaphor of the building, the temple, and that of the body. And we taught then in the context of the body, of the church as an organism, the church as this organic entity whereby all the parts kind of minister to each other and contribute to each other. And there is this intimate linkage and connection between all parts of the church. Now that, of course, is a wonderful thing. And there's thrilling potential in that, isn't there? Thrilling potential for gifts and ministry and support and help to flow between believers in the church. But at the same time, it's also a dangerous thing, isn't it? This reality of the church as an organism, yes, it's full of wonderful potential, but it's full of danger as well. Because it means that not only can good things flow between the different parts, but bad things can flow between the different parts as well. And sin and bad examples can flow between the different parts. And that's what is brought out in that second passage that we read, 1 Corinthians chapter 5. And again, you may well know the background to this passage, or you may well know the details of the passage, that it's this church in Corinth where, of course, there are all kinds of problems going on. And I suppose perhaps the worst of all is this incident of sexual immorality that is taking place in which a man has his father's wife, as we read in verse 1. And this then is a situation in which Paul is aware that the nature of the church as an organism is actually something dangerous because of this sin that is going on. He says, doesn't he, in verse 6, he doesn't use the same image of a body, he uses a different image. Your boasting is not good. Don't you know that a little yeast works through the whole batch of dough? So it's, as I say, a different image. It's the image here not of parts of the body, but of yeast and dough. But it's the same idea of sin now spreading because the church is designed in this way. Because there's this intimate connection between all its parts. Sin can spread so easily, just like yeast can spread so easily and does spread so easily throughout the dough. And so in the light of this then, in the light of this fact that sin can spread like a cancer, can spread so rapidly and so virulently within the church of Jesus Christ, there has to be some way of controlling it. There has to be some way of controlling the spread of bad things, of sin in the church. Now, of course, there is a limit to how it can be controlled. A believer in Jesus Christ cannot be actually removed from the church in the ultimate sense, can he? He cannot be removed from that entity that God elected in eternity and for which Christ laid down his life on the cross. Because if he were, then he wouldn't be a Christian anymore. He wouldn't be part of God's salvation anymore. So there's a limit to how far this control can be exercised. A person cannot be, in the ultimate and absolute sense, removed from the Church of Jesus Christ without becoming a non-Christian. And of course, that is absolutely impossible. But in order to control the spread of sin, something radical has to happen that comes as close to that as it is possible to come, to stop the sin spreading. And so Paul spells that out in language like verse 2. You are proud, shouldn't you rather have been filled with grief and have put out of your fellowship the man who did this? So as I say, he's not saying that this person can be removed from the Church of Jesus Christ in the ultimate sense. That would be impossible. But this person should, he says, have been put out of the fellowship. In other words, as close as it is possible to come to actually de-churching somebody should have happened in the case of this person, to control the sin so that it wouldn't spread to others and affect them as well. And it seems to me then, again, that for this to be possible, for it to be possible for this putting out of fellowship to take place, there needs to be something along the lines of church membership. So that while, as I say, the person cannot be excommunicated from the body of Jesus Christ, that person can be excommunicated for a while, and as Paul makes clear at the end of verse 5, ultimately for that person's good as well as for other reasons, that person can be excommunicated from the visible church, from the formal local church in its visible expression. His membership, her membership, can be removed. And that, I think, would constitute the kind of thing Paul is talking about here, a person being put out of the fellowship. And so, do you see what I'm saying then? That there's this dangerous possibility of sin being spread within the church because of its the way God has designed it, so intimately linked. And that needs to be controlled. And it seems to me that church membership is the only way, really, in which that biblical control can take place. And so I've given you then three reasons, or three justifications, rather, for church membership. Church membership recognizes a biblical fact. Church membership facilitates biblical leadership. And church membership makes possible a biblical control. Now, it's all been somewhat kind of nuts and bolts tonight, I'm afraid. And I suppose I'm really paving the way this week, as I was last week, for where the rubber hits the road in the next two sessions, the responsibilities of church membership. But just so that we go to our homes tonight, not just with nuts and bolts, but with something that we can feed on and can nourish us, I just want to close emphasizing the first point, because that, as I say, is, it seems to me, the primary justification of all for church membership. That it's a fact. If you are a Christian, you are a member of the church. And it seems to me, then, that every Christian should want that to be recognized, should want that great seminal truth of the doctrine of the church, and that seminal truth, therefore, of Christianity, in a way, to be recognized publicly and unmistakably and visibly. And I suppose it comes down to this at the end of the day, then. Do you appreciate the wonder of the Church of Jesus Christ? Do you appreciate the glory of the church? And as we said last week, we're not just individual Christians whom God is saving individually. We're part of something bigger than that. We're part of a specific thing in itself. We're part of a body. We're part of a building. And that's wonderful. That's glorious. That's something that should thrill us. And when it does, when you realize the privilege that is yours, not just being a follower of Jesus, not just being a believer, or whatever other individual terminology you might want to use, but being a part of the body, being a part of the building, when you realize the privilege of that, then I think you will want to become a member of the local church, because you will want it to be declared publicly and visibly that this is what God is doing. He's saving a church. Amen.